Hello, friends. It's your old pal, Ariel Helwani, on this Wednesday, July 3rd, 2019. I missed you. I hope you missed me, too. Feels like it's been a while since we last talked. I was off on Monday, July 1st, Canada Day, sort of a personal rule. I can't work on Canada Day. I mean, it's pretty much the holiest day of the year. And we missed reporters last week, but we are back, and we are better than ever. Back in the swing of things. And it's a good time to be back because it's UFC 239 fight week. There's a whole lot of things going on in the sport right now. A lot of news, a lot of things to get to. Hope you're all doing well. Hope you enjoyed your Canada Day. If you celebrate the 4th of July, I hope you have a great one on Thursday. Hope you're excited about International Fight Week and the Hall of Fame and all that stuff and more. I'm excited to get to Las Vegas. I head out on Thursday morning. A lot to do over there. Got a full slate of coverage, a lot of cool things. In fact, I will be doing, just to let you all know, a radio show in the middle of the prelims. Usually we do the radio show, like the ESPN radio show, you know, like the big one, on Saturday before the fights. This time we're doing it from 8:30 p.m. Eastern to 10 p.m. Eastern in the midst of the fights, and I'm allowed to talk about the fights. In fact, I'm allowed to do play-by-play if I want. I don't know if I'll do that, but that's pretty awesome. In the midst of, like, the meat of the card, we'll be doing the radio show, so if something crazy happens, you can call me, we could talk about it. I'm very excited about that. Also be doing a little bit of the NBA Summer League action, sideline action, if you will. I mentioned that on social media. I'm very excited about that. So this is pretty much a dream weekend for me. I'm pretty ecstatic. I'm pretty pumped. I can't wait. All right. So today on the program, we will talk to three of the best journalists in the game. Later in the show, The Athletic's own, my old friend, Sean Alshadi, will stop by, talk a little Michael Bisping, just put out a great feature on him, a little Hall of Fame, some other news and notes. We'll also talk to P.T. Carroll, the best journalist in Europe. No one covers the Eurobeat quite like him. Talk to him about the Cage Warriors card this past Saturday, the bloodiest main event that we've ever seen, maybe in the history of the sport. P.T. now a member of the ESPN MMA family. He's now contributing to our site as well, so that is very exciting. And I'm looking forward to more great work from him. His first article is already up on that historic event this past Saturday in London. But first, let me say hello to my old pal, Mark Raimondi, who I do believe is already in Las Vegas. Is that correct, Mark?
That is correct, my friend. I am here. I'm ready for International Fight Week. This is, I think, my 7th year in a row here in Vegas for the festivities.
How do you feel about it still being called International Fight Week? Because there's only one card. There's no other events. You know, in the past, it was like three events, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Then it went to Friday, Saturday. Actually, there was a time where it was Friday, Saturday, Sunday. There was even an Invicta card thrown in there. Like, that was a real, you know, kind of unique week. Now it's just pretty much, I mean, it's great. I'm not complaining, but it's no different than the March event in Las Vegas. Do you feel like it should still be called International Fight Week?
I would say that it is still a little bit different, and from a personal perspective, I don't mind the back-to-back-to-back cards. I appreciate them actually not doing that. I don't mind the Friday-Saturday. There have been some really cool moments on the Friday night and, of course, the Saturday shows as well. But one card is fine with me, but there's still the Hall of Fame on Friday. There's still the World MMA Awards on Wednesday night, which is tonight, I guess. The UFC fan experience, they have a bunch of the fighters come in. It's not quite the old expo, what they used to do, but there is still more this week, and it still feels like the kind of the tentpole of the year for the UFC, even despite there only being one card.
Okay. You've sold me. I actually missed the old expo. I thought those were a lot of fun. It was pretty cool. It was like a convention of sorts, and every fighter under the sun was there, and all the fans were there. It made the event seem a little bigger. I don't necessarily.
Yeah, they used to have a live jiu-jitsu competition.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wrestling tournament one year. Like it was a big deal. It felt like a much bigger deal. Now it's really more just kind of meet and greets with fighters.
Yeah, I remember Daniel Cormier even retired from wrestling at one of the at one of the expos, and he put his shoes in the middle of the mat and all that stuff. What I don't miss I don't miss the three events in a row. I don't even miss the two events in a row. I do miss, like, I thought it was great, and I think we've talked about this in the past, like when Invicta had an event. If I were Invicta, if I were LFA, if I were KSW, if I were Bellator, I would come this weekend in Las Vegas and put on a smaller show. I feel like they need to copy wrestling, what they do WrestleMania week. Again, I think we've talked about this in the past, but you actually do admit, like, you like the three events in a row. You like the two events in a row. I always felt like it just watered things down.
No. I don't mind the two, the Friday, Saturday too much. It is a lot, but, it does make for, like you said earlier, like it's a bigger week. The three events, and the event on Sunday was always a killer, because it was like everyone had already left. Everyone went home. It was, I remember Wonder Boy knocked out Jay Gallenberger that one year. I feel like in front of no one.
Yep.
At MGM Grand, it was almost kind of depressing. So I'm glad they don't do anything on Sunday anymore. They were doing the Hall of Fame on Sunday too at one point, and then they changed that too, which again is smart because everyone's gone. But I like one event. I don't mind two. Three was just way, way too much. And it's funny that you bring up how other MMA shows should come and run Thursday or Friday, and they should follow what wrestling does. Actually, there are two pro wrestling events on Friday night. They're piggybacking
what?
Off of the UFC 239 card on Saturday.
No way. Which events? Any, like, MMA guys?
Yeah, so FSW, the Future Stars of Wrestling, that's a local Las Vegas promotion, pretty good local indie promotion. They are doing an MMA-based event on Friday night, which is right after the Hall of Fame at 9 o'clock. I don't know where that is actually, but it is. There's an FSW. It's called Natural Born Killers, and I believe Frank Mir's on the card. Tom Lawler's on the card. Gina Mazzani, who's a UFC fighter, she's on the card. She's fighting Kira Batara. Well, she's wrestling Kira Batara, who is a Combate Americas veteran. There's a bunch of MMA people on that card.
Wow. Okay. It's amazing. The wrestling promotions get it a little bit more than the MMA promotions. I think in MMA.
You want to go? I have tickets.
No.
You're
actually going to go.
Yeah, why not? I'm going to go after the Hall of Fame. It's actually an event after that, even later.
Oh my gosh.
At night, it begins at 12:30 a.m. and I'm probably going to go to that as well.
I don't know if you are aware of this, but RJ Barrett is playing against Zion Williamson Friday night. Mark, we've got bigger fish to fry over at NBA Summer League, so we don't have time for this.
Yeah, but at 12:30 a.m.
Yeah, maybe not. But by then, I mean, I'll be all tapped out.
You know who's headlining? You know who's running that show? The one at 12:30?
Yeah, who?
Teddy Hart.
Wow, the great Teddy Hart is back. I didn't know that.
Yes, the nephew of Canadian legend,
yes.
Bret Hart.
Yes, I didn't know he was still active these days. Now, this is wrestling, right? Not MMA.
It's wrestling. Okay. No, it's he is active, and he's actually phenomenal. He's just he's been his own worst enemy over the years, but he's a phenomenal wrestler.
Wow. Okay. All right. So that's sort of setting the table for this weekend in Las Vegas. Let me ask you about UFC 239 in particular, because it is a great card. So far, we've only had one casualty, right? The Sean O'Malley fight. We were supposed to have JDS versus Ngannou, but then it got moved to last week because of the fact that the Robbie Lawler Tyron Woodley fight got canceled. And so it would have been great to have that on this card, but it's still a great card. No doubt about that. Which storyline, because there's a lot to choose from, are you most interested in going into Saturday night?
Ooh, that's a good question. I really think the fight that, and I think you may have asked me this a couple weeks ago, but I feel like the fight that interests me the most is Ben Askren versus Jorge Masvidal. As far as storyline goes, though,
wait, you're saying I asked you the same question a couple weeks ago about 239?
Maybe not.
Why would I have asked you that a couple weeks ago?
Someone else. Maybe I'm confusing you.
Jeez,
for someone
Louise.
Else, Ariel.
Why would I have asked you this a couple weeks ago? I would never do that.
I don't
that.
Know. Someone, I was asked this question a few weeks
okay,
ago.
Well,
but,
maybe next time get your facts right.
I think that the storyline, though, that interests me the most is Amanda Nunes coming in and defending the bantamweight title, now as the double champ, and Holly Holm trying to kind of find her legacy here, where She beat Ronda Rousey. It was the good thing going for a long time, and she hasn't quite lived up to that since. You know, she went on that 3-fight streak after that, and she has won 2 fights, but it hasn't been the kind of MMA career that people thought she would have. And so kind of those two things are meeting. Amanda Nunes trying to cement herself as really the best women's fighter of all time, and Holly Holm trying to, I guess, shock the world again, as she told me for an article that published today on ESPN.
Okay, so let me ask you about that article, because it's great. And as you mentioned, it went up this morning, Wednesday morning, on ESPN. And I thought you did a great job via your words of capturing who the new Holly Holm is, because she is somewhat new. She has gone through a lot of changes. She spoke to me about it on my show, but you were there, like, sitting in front of her face-to-face in Albuquerque. Can you explain to the people what's been going on in her life, and did you get a sense that this is a different person, a person with a sort of new lease on life?
I think that there's no doubt about it. I think the big difference for her is really and – It's one of those things where people go through personal stuff in MMA all the time. It's just part of life, and it's part of sports where, you know, you have a life outside the playing field, the competition area. And she finalized her divorce with her husband for 7 years in February, and they were separated for a year. But it was one of those things where her relationship with him and her personal life changed drastically after she beat Ronda Rousey, because she went from being, you know, a local hero in Albuquerque. She's very well known there. Very good, long time boxer, very good MMA fighter, to an international celebrity. I mean, she became really world famous when she beat Ronda Rousey. And from what she told me, her then husband was not really comfortable with being so much in the public eye, with her being in the public eye. So she felt guarded for many years. She felt guarded, like she really could not open up and be herself. And that did, it led to some tribulation, and it did leak into her training and her performances. Now she's very adamant that none of this stuff caused her loss. She would never want to put that out there, that she would never want to blame that and make excuses for her losses. But if you talk to the people around her, they will acknowledge that she had a rough few years from a personal standpoint.
You touched on this in the article, but if you follow her on social media, and in particular Instagram, like, she does seem like a different person. I don't know if she's making a conscious effort to put that out there, but she seems a lot freer, if you will, a lot happier, a lot, I don't know, goofy. Like, she's just putting out this different side of her. She's always kind of been somewhat reserved, somewhat stiff, if you will. She does seem to be in a much better place. And again, you never know with these things, especially when it comes to, like, relationships, if someone's just trying to project a different kind of image to get back at someone. Who knows? There's a lot there. But it does make you wonder, with that pressure off her shoulders, with those distractions out of the way, will we see a different Holly Holm, a better Holly Holm? Because she also mentioned this in your article. She's not getting blown out in these fights. And I know fans roll their eyes every time she gets a title fight. And they sort of feel like, okay, this is the last time. But she's 37. She's not getting beat up. She's not getting knocked out. She's not getting outclassed. Do you feel, and again, we're just speculating here, it's impossible to know until Saturday comes, but do you feel like it's possible that these changes in her life that seem to have had a positive effect on her might actually lead to her finally getting over that hump once again on Saturday?
It's certainly possible, and I do feel like that there is a lot of truth to what you said about. Something like posting videos on Instagram is kind of trivial. It seems kind of silly, but if that's really the place where she was a few years ago, where she was walking on eggshells and really afraid to put herself out there, and afraid to cause, like, drama inside her own home. You can imagine what kind of effect that could have on her outwardly, and how that would manifest itself in her performances. And I really think what as much as that, Ariel, I think that if you look back at her Megan Anderson fight, it looked like a different Holly Holm when she fought Megan Anderson. She wrestled. I mean, she used her grappling. It was a different side of her game that we really haven't seen before. And people forget that she really didn't start MMA training until she was in her 30s, and she's 37 now. But I mean, she didn't train, she didn't wrestle or grapple at all, but she was boxing, and she had a full long decade, you know, decade plus career in boxing where she didn't do any wrestling or grappling. So she's really still relatively new comparatively to the women she's facing in that aspect of the game, and she showed that off in the Anderson fight last June. And if you look at, you know, some of the quotes in my story, you know, Greg Jackson said he feels like we haven't even seen the best version of Holly Holm yet. That she's gonna probably fight into her 40s and still be very good. We know how great of an athlete she is. I mean, she's still in incredible shape, and she hasn't lost any of those fights by wide margins. She hung in with Cyborg for a very long time, and there are things in those fights that you look at and you say, like, you know what, she can build off those things and get better. And I think that's possible.
Up until this point, her legacy has been defined by the win over Ronda Rousey back at UFC 193. And I know that she kind of gets annoyed about that sort of thing. But in a weird way, and I don't think I'm being too overly dramatic here, I feel like a win on Saturday could be legacy defining or redefining for her, in the sense that then her story is she shocked the world at 193 in Melbourne, and then went through these ups and downs, and then went on the brink of sort of being irrelevant, and then she was able to somehow climb her way back up and beat arguably the greatest of all time in Amanda Nunes. And so, you know, like, it's not just that she's fighting for the bantamweight title on Saturday or trying to become a two-time champion at 135. I really feel like she can change the entire narrative of her entire career, especially her UFC career, with a win on Saturday. And that's not, like, if Thiago Santos shocks the world, I mean, that is gigantic, and it's sort of the same type of thing that she did against Ronda Rousey. But in this, like, if she loses to Amanda Nunes, then it's just, yeah, she was the one who, you know, won at 193. She made the mistake of fighting Miesha Tate. She didn't wait for the rematch. She wasn't able to regain her form. She was so close but never got over the hump. Here she wins, everything changes. That whole story of the past 3+ years changes. It's pretty amazing.
I completely agree. It's a fascinating again storyline going to this fight, because you're absolutely right. If she's able to beat Nunes, who by the way, kind of like Ronda Rousey, everyone thinks is going to win this fight. Everyone thinks that she's going to win by a pretty wide margin. And if Holm does it, it does change everything about how she's viewed. And this is not a person, Ariel, who just, you know, is fighting for the sake of fighting or fighting to make a living or fighting to be in the top five or what have you. Like, she really still wants to be viewed as the best women's fighter of all time. She really does want that. And when she knocked out Rousey was regarded as that. And that has changed over the years. It was Cyborg, and then now it's probably Nunes. And Holm is not really in that conversation, but she can put herself in that conversation again on Saturday. So it really is it's fascinating on a number of levels.
You get the sense, now let's go to the main event, you get the sense at all that John Jones is looking past Thiago Santos?
I don't know. I mean, it's so hard to say with John Jones. I would say probably not, but does that even matter? I mean, this is a guy who at one point in time was partying the week of fights and possibly doing some illicit drugs, if you listen to some of his stories, the week of fights and still beating top contenders. So what does it really mean, even if he is looking past Thiago Santos? Even if he is, I would still call him a huge favorite.
The one thing about John Jones is his fighter IQ is off the charts. He's a very smart fighter. He's not the kind of fighter to disrespect his opponent or take him lightly. I know he said some things where people are like, oh, he might be looking past him and Santos has power and he can knock him out, 4-ounce gloves. All those things are true. But I feel like if you are going to catch John Jones, it was when he was partying fight week. I don't get the sense that he's doing that as much these days. And so I feel like he respects Santos's power. I know he said to me last week that, like, look, I have fought guys who hit just as hard, but they can set up their punches. Santos doesn't really set up his punches. He just kind of swings for the fences. And that may be true. That doesn't mean that you should completely overlook him and disrespect him. I just don't see, like, I'm very intrigued by this fight. I'm very intrigued by the co-main event as well. Other than catching him, other than, you know, and we've never seen John in that situation before. We've never seen John on wobbly legs, on roller skates, in the GSP Serra situation where he needs to regroup, regain his bearings. We've never seen him, you know, respond to that kind of adversity. But other than that sort of thing happening in the first round, I have a hard time seeing how Thiago Santos wins this fight.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know what the path to victory is outside of that. I think what people, and you hit on this, I think what people kind of forget John Jones is that, yes, physically he has a ton of advantages over his opponents, usually when it comes to length and athleticism and cardio, but he is a genius in the octagon. I mean, he is just a fighting savant. It's really what he was born to do. The way that he makes adjustments, and of course, you know, credit to his coaches, Greg Jackson and Mike Winklejohn and Brandon Gibson and Izzy Martinez, those guys at Jackson Wink, but he just has an innate sense of fighting, and he can beat fighters in a variety of different ways. And Thiago Santos does not have that same type of quality. He really has not shown that he can beat fighters in a variety of different ways. I wouldn't call him one-dimensional, but he's certainly not as dimensional as John Jones.
He has scary power. I would argue he has scarier power than Anthony Smith. It does feel like, at least to me, that John Jones is on the cusp of a high-profile fight, whether it's Luke Rockhold, who's fighting on this card, making his 205-pound debut, whether it's Chris Weidman, who may be one win away from being in that title picture. Maybe it's Daniel Cormier. That would be the biggest fight possible for John Jones right now. But it does feel like if he gets by this Anthony Smith, Thiago Santos, you know, little run here, he's on the cusp of something. So I wonder, is he looking past Santos? Again, doesn't strike me as that kind of guy. Strikes me as the kind of guy who's trying to make up for lost time, make more money these days because he was so inactive over the past couple of years. I just feel like if John Jones is John Jones, and I know that that's somewhat, you know, kind of lazy analysis, there's nothing really that Thiago Santos could do other than trying to catch him early that John really needs to be worried about. Now, I want to ask you about the Ben Askren-Jorge Masvidal fight. Does it feel like, at least to you, that the stakes have been raised going into this fight? And they were very high. There's great heat there between the two of them. Askren is undefeated. Masvidal is on a roll. But do you feel like once they announced that Colby Covington was fighting Robbie Lawler on August 3rd, that the stakes changed and perhaps got raised for this fight?
I think certainly. I think now that there is that question mark where there was a time when Kamaru Usman first beat Tyron Woodley that it seemed like Colby Covington was going to be the next opponent in relatively short order when Usman got healthy. Now, who knows? I mean, it's a wild card. Now that Covington's fighting Robbie Lawler in Newark in really just a few weeks, right, the beginning of August, it kind of renews the question mark of who Usman fights next. And you know that if Ben Askren beats Masvidal, and even if Masvidal beats Ben Askren, there will be a lot of fan support behind either one of those guys to fight Usman next, more than there is for Covington. Which, look, I mean, Colby Covington is Colby Covington, and his methods over the last few years have been interesting, to say the least. But I think we can agree that he did deserve to get that title shot at some point.
Yeah.
And now it looks like he may not get it next. I mean, if he beats Robbie Lawler, he could still get that shot against Usman, but someone else might jump the line in front of him again, the way that Usman did. So it's very interesting. And yes, it does add another layer to what a fight that I was already extremely, extremely excited about.
How do you feel about Colby accepting this fight? Were you surprised?
Oh, yeah, I was quite surprised. I was quite surprised. I didn't think that I really thought that he would be the next guy, although I didn't have, in the back of my mind, I did kind of think that if one of those guys, Askren and Masvidal, won impressively and made a lot of noise in the post-fight, which they have been known to do, there would be an upswell. There would be kind of a energy behind one of them to get that title shot next. And I wonder if Covington knew that too, but I feel the UFC just, I mean, it's one of those situations, Ariel, where the UFC had a spot on the calendar. They had a main event. It wasn't supposed to be in Newark. It was supposed to be in Russia originally. They had to make some last minute changes. They put it out there to Covington, and they probably gave him an ultimatum, and he had to do it. He had to fight Robbie Lawler.
Yeah, that is kind of the situation. I feel like Colby Covington has lost a little bit of momentum. When you think about the heat that he had after he beat RDA in Chicago. That was nuclear stuff. When you think about just 2 months later, he was in the White House. When you think about the fact that he hasn't fought since, and, you know, you had the Tyron Woodley fight, and that was, I mean, that could have been a huge fight. And we're talking about Colby Covington. This is a guy who, like, was just sort of like a mid-tier welterweight, didn't have a lot of buzz, and all of a sudden everyone's just foaming at the mouth thinking of a potential fight between him and Woodley. Woodley loses, so you potentially lose that, or at least it's on ice. And then the Usman thing comes in, and it's almost like a gift from God because they have the altercation at the Palms the next day, and all of a sudden that has the same kind of heat, and now that gets put on ice. And so this is very dangerous for Colby Covington, because let's not forget, Robbie Lawler, very underrated when it comes to fighting wrestlers. Almost beat Ben Askren, has had great performances against wrestlers in the past. Probably his worst performance was against Woodley, and he didn't get out-wrestled there. He just got caught very early, got knocked out. But this is a fight that he could lose, especially when you consider the time off. I know Robbie is dealing with a similar layoff. I'm somewhat surprised he took the fight. I think he was backed into a corner. I think the UFC pretty much made him take the fight. And I think he recognizes that Kamaru Usman probably isn't going to fight until November. Maybe around MSG, and so he has to be active, he has to earn money. But I feel like we have a situation here where, like, Askren I don't think is 100% correct. I know he's saying, like, look, I told you all. I feel like we have a situation like we had around 7 years ago, UFC on Fox 4 in LA, where the guy who looks the best of these four is going to get the title shot. If Askren wins, but then Colby does something dramatic, he'll get the title shot. If Askren wins and does something amazing and Colby just kind of squeaks by, or Lawler squeaks by, then Askren will get it. I think we have to wait until August 4th, because there's still 3 months after that until Usman comes back probably, to really determine who's the number one contender.
That sounds right. And you have to wonder, did the UFC kind of squander whatever was there, for better or worse, when it comes to Covington? Because he did have so much momentum behind him. He did have he did make himself into the big story. He was one of the big stories that week in March, when he fought Usman. He was one of the big stories of that card, and he had a lot of heat then. And then he got into that altercation with Usman, as you said, at the Palms Buffet. Just trying to get some shrimp cocktail, Ariel.
No, I think it was crab legs. Crab legs.
I'm sorry, crab legs.
Yes.
My apologies. I mixed up my seafood. Over the last year plus, I mean, he's had momentum behind him, and the UFC has kind of squandered him. And look, I mean, there are places that fight promotion might have gone, and I'm talking about against Woodley and then also against Usman, that would have been very uncomfortable. And part of me is glad that we haven't seen it yet, but the UFC is leaving money on the table. I mean, I feel like they did leave money on the table by not having Covington fight for the title, at least until right now.
There have been times in the past where they made a fight, they had a fight, a potentially lucrative fight, in the distance, waiting for them, but they had to fill up dates, and so they made a fight and played with fire, and often it has worked out in their favor. In this particular case, it may not. In this particular case, they're somewhat lucky because Askren has pretty good heat with Usman as well. And so if Askren wins, and Masvidal has – so, like, there's no right answer. But you can't help but wonder, like, Colby fighting against Usman and or Woodley, if those fights don't come to fruition because of scheduling or politics, it would really be a shame. And so I'm really curious to see what happens Saturday with that Askren-Masvidal fight. Also, what happens August 3rd in Newark with that Colby Covington Robbie Lawler fight. Let me ask you about
I'm sorry to interrupt you. One last point here. They also kind of, I don't want to say they lucked into Ben Askren, but they were fortunate that Ben Askren was able to come in, make as much waves as he has, beat Robbie Lawler, and really become one of the big stars of the UFC over the last 8, 9 months, 10 months. That was no guarantee when that trade was brokered last October with Demetrius Johnson and one championship. So they kind of they didn't luck into it, but they've certainly been very fortunate that they have someone who could be as big of a money draw in that welterweight division, probably more than even Colby could.
Let me ask you about a story that broke late last night, courtesy of MMA Junkie. They had it first around a month or so ago. John Lineker, one of the more popular lighterweight fighters, action-packed, never has a dull fight, one of the hardest-hitting lighterweight fighters of all time, no doubt about that, goes out in the media and says, I want to be active. If you're not going to fight me more often, I want out. I want to be released. So they give him a fight on short notice against Rob Font, June 22nd in Greenville, around 2 weeks' notice. And as the story goes, courtesy of his manager, Alex Davis, who spoke on the record about this, he gets cut the day before the weigh-ins, goes to the hospital. He gets cleared by the doctors, gets cleared by the UFC, but says, no, I don't want to fight. Late last night, we find out he has been released from the UFC. What do you make of this?
Do you think that John Lineker has finessed the UFC in this incident?
What do you mean, finesse?
Do you think that all along he was trying to be released?
I don't think all along he was trying to be released. I think that's a crazy take, and I want to ask you about that. I just think, since you asked me, you can't back the UFC into a corner. I feel like a lot of people listening are expecting me to say, this is crazy, he's ranked, he's popular, yeah, he's a contender. You can't call them out and say, fight me more often. They give you a fight days later, and then you get cut, something happens, although he hasn't really spoken about it, but clearly something happened because that's what his team said. And then you get cleared by all parties involved, and then you say you want out. You can't, like, on June 20th, the day before, June 21st, the day of the weigh-ins, I had a feeling he was done because you can't do that. Like, if there's one thing we know about the UFC, you can't call them out and then not deliver. And so not only did I expect it, I kind of agree with it. I really don't have any problems with this. Like, as much as it sucks that he's not in the UFC anymore, but he's had opportunities with the weight cut stuff and all that, I really am not upset or bothered or all that surprised by it.
I'm certainly not outraged by it, purely speculation here, but I feel like for someone like him, it was a short notice fight. He's had weight cut issues in the past. I wonder how much, going to the hospital, losing that time to cut the weight, mess with his weight cut, and maybe he wasn't going to make it on Friday morning, or maybe he just didn't want to go through with a really hard weight cut overnight. Just purely speculation on my part, but that's not an excuse. I mean, like you said, he called the UFC out. They gave him the chance. He accepted it, and then he backed out at the last minute for whatever reason. So I'm certainly not outraged by this. Am I bummed that John Lineker is no longer in the UFC? Yeah, I mean, he in that bantamweight division, he is a highlight. He is a guy that you're always when he gets booked for a card, you want to see that fight. You know, he's always exciting. So it is a bummer, but I'm not like losing my mind over it.
All I know is Bellator Ryzen, they need to figure out a way to sign him to have him fight Kyoji Horiguchi, right? I mean, that's just a no-brainer. I know Bellator is interested. I know there's been some talks since the news came out. We'll see if it gets done. But that, that is just like, that's like falling, that's just like perfect, right?
Oh, I mean, Horiguchi is so hot right now. I mean, wherever that fight happens, whether it be in Bellator or Ryzen or I mean, I don't care. I mean, it doesn't matter. Brazil, wherever that fight happens, I am watching it. That's huge.
That would be a great fight. I feel like they figure out a way to get that done because that's the perfect kind of opponent. Whether it's in Ryzen, Horiguchi is the Ryzen champ, or Bellator, he just became the Bellator bantamweight champ. It makes all the sense in the world. Another story that broke this morning, courtesy of Brett Okamoto of ESPN, Joanna Jędrzejczyk is going to fight Michelle Waterson on October 12th. They're going to open up the brand new Chase Center in San Francisco. Open it up as far as UFC is concerned. They're not the first event to happen there, but that's the new home of the Golden State Warriors. And I had someone reach out to me and say, I can't believe Michelle Waterson is taking this fight. Well, first of all, we know Tatiana Suarez is injured. She's dealing with a neck injury and there's no real timetable for her return. And I feel like this actually makes all the sense in the world. It's happening at 115. It's happening several weeks after the Zhang Weili versus Jessica Andrade title fight. If she beats Joanna, there's no denying her a shot at the title. Like, that secures her spot as the number one contender without a doubt, in my opinion. To me, it feels like a no-brainer. What do you think?
No, this is actually phenomenal matchmaking. I love it because no matter who wins that fight, you have a story. There's a story there, especially if Andrade wins. And even if she doesn't, because if Joanna Jędrzejczyk beats Waterson, and let's say Tatiana Suarez is still going to be out for a little bit, you get in the hot shot Jędrzejczyk right back into a title fight. I know it sounds crazy, but especially if it's against Andrade, she's beaten her. She has a win over her. And if it's against Weili Zhang, I mean, it's a phenomenal fight too. And if Waterson wins, of course, it's her title shot. She deserves it at that point. I mean, you could make the argument that she already does deserve it. And then, she gets the title shot that she's been seeking for so many years. You know, she's a veteran of the game. She's trying to become the first mom to win a UFC title. The stories are great coming out of that, no matter what happens. I think it really is a clever bit of matchmaking.
Stay right there, Mark, because we have a bit of breaking news here. I'm being told by our great producer, Troy, that our next guest, a man you may have heard of, has a bone to pick with you. So let's go to Dublin right now. Let's go to P.T. Carroll, who is standing by. P.T., what is your issue with Mark?
I mean, I'm sitting here and I'm sweating for the last 10 minutes waiting for him to get off the phone. I mean, what was so important that you guys had to talk about to leave me hanging like this? It's desperate. I'm very upset about it. What's going on, Mac?
Why are you sweating? I'm the one in Las Vegas.
Listen, it's hard in Hawaii here at the moment, my friend, and you know how freckly I am. I don't take the sun very well.
Well, PT,
I'm sorry to hear that, my friend. Well, this is just retribution for you, PT, because at my going away party at MMAfighting.com, the Zoom call, the video call for my going away party, you showed up late. You showed up late. So now I'm going to keep you waiting.
Well, here's the thing.
I knew that was happening. I knew he was trying to get me back for something.
I'll take it one step further, and I will say that this is sort of the initiation process, because PT is now the newest member of the squad. He's now contributing, as I said at the top of the show, to the ESPN MMA team. And so we wanted to keep you waiting just to humble you a little bit. You're getting all kinds of praise for all your work. Everyone's loving you, feeling you. This is to just let you know that, you know, there's a process here and there's a pecking order.
So I'm like the water boy now, is that it? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Listen, I have too much respect for you to paint you with that kind of brush, but I felt like you just needed to be humbled a little bit.
Listen, guys, I want this to be the last time this happens, right? Initiation over. I'm in now. This is the last time this happens. I don't want to have this conversation with you again, Mark.
Can you please fetch me a Guinness, PC?
Oh,
can you get a man a Guinness?
You had to go there. Mark, great talking to you. I'll see you out there in Vegas. Please hold it down before I get there. And I'm looking forward to covering our first International Fight Week together for ESPN. We've covered many for MMA fighting in the day, but this is our first for ESPN, so it's a very special time for us.
Thanks, Ariel. It's great to hear your voice, Mr. Carroll. I'll talk to you guys soon.
All right, there he is, Mr. Mark Raimondi, stopping by. Mr. P.T. Carroll, before I get to you, I do want to tell our listeners about a very exciting thing going on here at ESPN. So if you can just stand by for one more minute, if you don't mind, because I know that there are a lot of big UFC fans listening to us, and quite frankly, this is the opportunity of a lifetime. As part of a ultimate UFC fan experience, you will get access to the ins and outs of the entire behind-the-scenes production, courtesy of this once-in-a-lifetime situation, this deal. Okay, listen to this. All right? You listening? Everyone listening, sit down. Strap your seatbelt. You're going to get a one-year membership to UFC Gym to train yourself. Plus, you can enjoy all the UFC matches with a year-long ESPN Plus subscription. This experience that I'm telling you about includes this: 4 VIP tickets to attend UFC 243 in Las Vegas on October 5th, 2019. Attend a private meet and greet with Dana White. Receive 2 VIP stage passes for an upcoming weigh-in, meet and greet, and autograph session with fighters backstage. Backstage pass and VIP tour of the production, including a tour of the production truck and ring access before the fight. Get a VIP tour of UFC headquarters. Receive a UFC Gym membership for 1 year. Receive an ESPN Plus subscription for 1 year. Receive a pair of signed gloves from one of the main event fighters. All you have to do to get all that is visit ebay.com/ESPN to bid on the ultimate UFC fan experience. 100% of the proceeds, and this is the best part, will benefit the V Foundation for cancer research, because like Jimmy V once said, in the fight against cancer, we'll never give up. Now, doesn't that sound amazing, Mr. P.T. Carroll?
Yeah, it sounds. I can't believe it. I personally can't wait to enter the draw for the prize, to be honest with you.
All right. Well, you have to bid over at, once again, let me tell you the address, if you don't mind, ebay.com/ESPN. ebay.com/ESPN. That's where you can bid on all of that. And again, 100% of the proceeds benefit the V Foundation. Now, P.T. Carroll, you were in London last week, and I want you to paint the scene for us, pardon the pun, but if you can, you were there for a Cage Warriors event, a very special Cage Warriors event. Now, Cage Warriors doesn't get a lot of attention on this side of the pond, And a lot of fans just sort of, you know, there was a big UFC, there was Ngannou, JDS, all that stuff and more. But this was, in some respects, a historic event, and the ending was historic in its own right. Like, it was historic going into it, and then it became even more historic because of how it ended. Can you tell us why this particular Cage Warriors event that you covered last week in London was so special, and what happened in the aftermath?
Right, so Cage Warriors for us, this is the proven path to the UFC. I mean, they've produced 91 fighters for the UFC in its 17-year history. I think it's 17 or 18-year history now. They have a genius matchmaker that called Ian Dean, who nurtures this talent. Guys that you might know them, Conor McGregor, Michael Bisping, Dan Hardy, Joanny and Jacek. This is just four of the 90-odd names. But most recently is Jack Shore. And this was the first time since they unveiled their championship titles that they put six titles on the line. Now, those titles are considered to be golden tickets to the UFC. Again, the same names that I just said, McGregor, Bisping, Hardy, they all held these belts before they went on to the UFC, and obviously we know how great they did there. But this was the first time since they were unveiled 14 years ago that many titles were put on the line that night. And really, it's the most pure sport event, I think, that exists in MMA. Because everybody's fighting for that piece. There's no kind of fighting about money, squabbling about money. Everybody wants that gold belt. And you get to watch these guys as soon as they come into the Cage Warriors rank. You get to see them being nurtured, being pitted against better guys every step of the way. There's always a step up in competition. And then you get to see them eventually fight for these belts. And the night itself was absolutely incredible. To see the emotions out of these fighters afterwards, the losers and the winners, absolutely astronomical. And of course, the main event was one of the craziest things we've ever seen. It had to be stopped in the third round due to the vinyl surface becoming basically unplayable, as they'd say in soccer and rugby or American football you have over there. I mean, you just couldn't actually fight anymore because there was so much blood on the canvas. So the fight had to be called off. It was a no contest. And as we know, Nicholas Dalby and Ross Houston both thought with a win there that they would be going back to the UFC. Well, Dalby back to the UFC, Ross would have been going to the UFC for the first time. But because it ends in no contest, we don't get that kind of closure. And it was just an unbelievable thing to see. I mean, I went back to the medical room afterwards. These guys are both getting stitched up beside each other. You see some of the most hardened names in MMA, guys who usually don't raise an eyebrow to absolutely anything that happened, all standing outside, shaking their heads, going, "This is unbelievable. We've never seen anything like this before in our lives." You could smell the blood. There was a metallic smell, a heavy metallic smell in the air everywhere around this medical box. That's how much blood these guys had lost. I know that's not the most pretty image in the world, but to see guys put themselves through that just to get that shot at the UFC, I think it's the most pure sport thing we have, absolutely, in Europe anyway, definitely, in terms of MMA. And it was a really, really amazing night, an epic night that will be looked back in the same light, I feel, as Conor McGregor winning his second title with Cage Warriors. We always see those iconic images with him with both belts over his shoulder. And I feel like this night will live on like that for many, many years. And we'll be looking back at Ross Houston's career and Nicholas Dalby's career and talking about that night every time we bring them up, you know.
So you did a great job of painting the picture in your article like that. When you talk about the metallic smell of the blood, it makes me a little nauseous and lightheaded, but I could smell it. I feel like I could almost taste it. And to the best of my knowledge, and I don't know if you came across this in your reporting afterwards or in your research, I don't recall a fight, especially one of that magnitude and on that kind of stage, ever ending because there was too much blood on the canvas. Have you ever heard of that before?
No, and I spoke to Mark Goddard at length about this. He, I mean, how many
right.
Fights has Mark ref at this stage? I mean, I think he's been at it for 16 years, and he referees every weekend. And, like, I mean, back in the day, at that first event when they unveiled his Cage Warriors titles in 2005, he actually refereed every single championship match that night. That was 9 championship matches back in 2005. So, I mean, this guy has such a vast array of experience. He told me he had never seen a situation like that in his life. You know, if it had have gone to the three, if it had have completed the three rounds, they would have been able to go to a technical decision. But as he could see, he was very worried that the fight would be won due to a mistake because the surface became so treacherous. So it's just amazing to pick his brain about it because, as we know, Mark seldom gets excited when he's in his role. He's very dominant. He just does what he has to do. But, I mean, you can see it when you watch that fight back. He's looking at the other officials going, "This is ridiculous." Like, it's audible. You can hear it. It's just such a freak show, really. But a tremendous, tremendous fight. And as I said, like, Nicholas Dalby, you'll know all about Nicholas Dalby's struggles. You remember that great article Chuck Mendenhall wrote about him for MMA Fighting when you were there, about his depression and how he'd been partying too much between camps, and basically he ends up in this cycle of depression. But then he fights back, and he could have went anywhere. He could have went, I'm sure, anywhere after that. He's a huge name in Europe. I'm sure, as we know, Bellator are trying to invest heavily in this market. But he chose to go back to Cage Warriors because he wants to go back to the UFC. And in this amazing story, you know, he stumbled at the first hurdle when he came back. He lost a split decision. And he said, you know, he did feel that depression creeping in again, but he fought back, got two amazing wins over an Irish veteran named Phil Mulpeter, a brilliant fighter, and Alex Lahore, a man who held the Bama title. He beat both these guys, ends up in this situation. It feels like the resurrection of Nicholas Dalby will be complete that night. And as we see, the surface denies him that opportunity to get back in the UFC for that his home card, that Copenhagen card on September 28th. So he's still obviously trying to get his name there. Having spent a lot of time around him this week and for the last few months, I think, you know, it's clear to see the Danish people would love to see him there. But because of the damage that's been inflicted in this fight, he suffered a really bad cut in the first round. That was a lot of the blood you see in the canvas. And he also, they were thinking he might have broken his nose. I haven't checked in with him since because you want to give these guys a bit of space after something like that. But, yeah, I mean, that's the story now. Is he going to be able to be medically cleared? Will the UFC afford him that opportunity to come back? It's still, the story goes on despite the night itself ending, you know.
Did you notice that the UFC Europe Twitter account retweeted something about it with, like, I think the thinking emoji or something like that? Like, they never do stuff like that. To me, that was, like I can't stress it enough. They never do stuff like that. That was an indication that if both guys can do it, that they want to make that rematch on the Copenhagen card. Did you come away with the same thinking?
That was what Ross Houston, he was on a gurney in the medical room and I was doing that final interview for the ESPN article. There was blood all over my phone because his nose was just pouring blood as he was trying to speak to me. And that's what he said. He said it in the ring as well. He said, I want a rematch in Copenhagen. I'll go to his hometown and do it. And I really feel like that story generated, like, I mean, the fight itself generated so much interest. Everybody was talking about it. I feel like it's a perfect thing to do, and I really feel as though the UFC get it wrong a lot in Europe. You know, we aren't the primary market. I feel like a lot of the times, a lot of the fans can be a bit deflated with the cards that they put on over here. So I think Dalby and Houston from that Cage Warriors card, the fact that it generated so much regional interest, that would be a real winner, a real hit with the fans. And honestly, I think the UFC should be doing more with Cage Warriors as it is, because, I mean, when you have that kind of conveyor belt of talent coming out of a promotion, I know they're on Fight Pass and stuff like that, but I feel like they could even solidify, they could fortify that relationship between the two promotions, because this guy Ian Dean is clearly a genius at nurturing talent. Like, I mean, if you have that kind of success rate, like this fella is the furthest thing from a guy who's going to toot his own horn and tell everybody how great he is. He completely shuns the spotlight. So, like, with my opportunity on the show, that's what I'd say to these guys. Like, too many times in Europe, UFC come over with cards and the fans aren't into it. This guy has produced it year after year after year for the last two decades. I think it would be a good thing for them to maybe at least consult with him, you know, or consult with these rosters who are generating interest in the region when they're putting on their cards out here.
It's amazing, and you nailed it. He's one of the best-kept secrets in the sport, in particular because of the amount of talent that he's been able to find and produce over the past few years, because it's a great skill. When you have a promotion where you're essentially, you're working as a AAA affiliate, if you will, a minor league system, not the fighters aren't minor league, but like you are ready and willing to give up even your champions, your biggest stars to the bigger promotions and in particular the UFC. And he just continues to lose fighters and then just in like a couple of years, like replace them with other draws, with other names, with other people. It's amazing what he's done. Right now, how would you define the state of Cage Warriors? Because there was a period not that long ago where they were like essentially dead, where they weren't putting on events. It seemed like they weren't producing much. These days, how healthy are they?
I think they're very healthy. I think they are sustainable, which is the most important thing. There's so many times that we see different promotions kick off over here. They promise the fighters the sun, moon, and stars, and then they're here for, you know, 2-3 years and then they'll disappear. So I think that sustainability for us is a big thing. The fact that we will see cage warriors, the fact that that is the path to the UFC is always a selling point, and nobody else can even compare to that in terms of producing talent for the UFC in Europe. Absolutely nobody. So that's always going to be their selling point. I do feel as though that is the key, like sustainability. They've been around. They've, as you know, they hit that hiatus there and they came back in 2014. Joseph Duffy was subsequently signed. I think he might have had one or two fights and then he was off to the races. Then Dalby was gone. Like, I mean, that's what I feel like it needs to be. You know, you might have seen there's a bit of back and forth going on between Bellator and Cage Warriors. These are two promotions that are competing on the same terrain, and that kind of volatility is always there, really. It's always been a part of that. And if you even read Sean Al-Shadi's piece there about Michael Bisping, you see Ian Dean talking about these things. There was crazy times back then, but that is still, they're very fiercely protective of that that plot out there, and I can see why there's a bit of tension between Bellator and Cage Warriors in that respect, you know?
Yeah, 100%. Well, again, I urge anyone who missed the article up on ESPN.com to go check it out. It was a great introductory article to the wonderful mind and the great skill that P.T. Carroll possesses as a writer. You did a great job with that. So, again, thank you very much, and I'm very excited that you're now a part of the team. I did want to ask you a couple more things before I let you go, P.T. I know it's hot over there, and you've been very patient with us, but please, if you can hang on for 5 more minutes. Also that night.
Only for you, Ariel.
Thank you.
Only for you.
Francis Ngannou won that night, this past Saturday. He knocked out JDS. That's now 3 straight wins, and it's amazing to think where he was around 52 weeks ago. He was in Las Vegas, T-Mobile Arena, getting booed out of the building because of his performance against Derek Lewis, was unable to pull the trigger. And, you know, an hour later, or less than an hour later, Brock Lesnar walks into the cage and disparages him, makes fun of him. I mean, his stock couldn't have been lower. And now here we are a year later, knocks out Curtis Blaydes, knocks out Cain Velasquez, knocks out Junior Dos Santos. Is there any question that his next fight should be for the heavyweight title?
I don't think so. I think it absolutely should be. You know, I really expected Junior Dos Santos to really, you know, really test him, to be honest. I think Junior is amazing. I think he's a fantastic boxer, especially. And I thought that would be a very interesting matchup. And to deal with Junior like that, a former champion, like, I mean, it's unbelievable. You know, like, he's obviously found something. He's gone back to the drawing board in some respects. But, like, when he hits people, it's just devastating. The noise of it, even. Like, Jesus Christ, man. You know, he's an unbelievable puncher. He has got unbelievable power. And, I mean, who honestly is putting their hand up going, oh, I can't wait to fight Francis Ngannou? I don't think anybody is. And that includes Stipe Miocic, probably, even though he had such a dominant win about him before. You know, it's a dangerous, dangerous man to get in there with. And I feel like, you know, that the whole thing with the French legalization thing as well. I know he's from Cameroon, but he's been in there where he's lived in France for a long time. You know, I think that would be something that would be huge for him as well. I'm sure the UFC are looking for that in 2020. But yeah, certainly you'd expect him to be fighting for the heavyweight title next. But a few things need to be sorted out before then, of course.
In my opinion, the big question is not whether he should get a heavyweight title shot next. It's whether he should, you know, or will be fighting Stipe Miocic if Stipe wins on August 17th, or is he fighting for the vacant title? Because I think that if DC wins on August 17th, he's either A, retiring, or B, will vacate the title to go down and fight John Jones one last time at 205, or Stipe wins and then, you know, you have a champion and then you can run the rematch. So to me, the big question is, not should he fight for the belt next. I feel like that's 100% yes. There's no argument to be made. It's just against two, and we'll find out the answer to that question maybe on August 17th. Do you have any issues with seeing him versus Stipe again?
No, not at all. I think it's got new legs now, right? Because he's come back and he's been so dominant. I think that's a fight we want to see. We also haven't seen Stipe in so long. So, yeah, absolutely. I think that's definitely a fight that would be interesting to see. But, you know, this sport just changes crazy. Like, I mean, an event can change everything. Like, I mean, I don't think Francis' situation is going to change as the number one contender, the next guy to fight for that belt. But we'll have to see what goes down. Like, do you feel like there's absolutely no way Jones will go up to heavyweight? I know he says he doesn't, but do you feel like DC v. Jones could never happen at heavyweight?
I don't want to say never. I just don't think that DC wants it at heavyweight. And I don't think John Jones wants it at heavyweight. I think the UFC is interested in it at heavyweight, but I think Jones is going to say, like, why am I going to go up there if you know, you're so good there and you're so much more comfortable there. And DC's line of thinking is just because he's such a competitor, you know, you beat me twice at 205. It doesn't count if I beat you at heavyweight. And so if I'm going to do this, I'm going to go down. Does it end up happening? You know, we may never know. It may be a moot point and it may never, you know, actually come to fruition. It may just be a thing that we'll always dream. Like, does the fight at heavyweight look different than the fight at 205? But I believe both guys have no interest in the fight happening at heavyweight.
I think the fans, though, really do. You know,
every time I
hear people talking about this, I think that's the fight they want to see, you know? So, like, I mean, if anyone can throw a spanner in the works, I guess it's John Jones. But as you say, he doesn't seem to want that. But, you know, people change their minds very quickly in MMA, as you know, Ariel.
Yes, they certainly do. I mean, look, we'll see what happens this weekend with John. Don't want to overlook Thiago Santos. Luke Rockhold is out there, who's a friend and teammate of Daniel Cormier, so that could change things. As I said earlier, Chris Weidman is coming
Blackowicz
to the two.
Which could change things as well.
Well, now you're showing your European bias.
Let's not forget about that.
Yeah.
I was talking to Joanna, Michael Materla, the KSW, the former KSW champion. They think that, I know they're countrymen of their fellow Poles, but they believe that a big shock is in order. I was actually only speaking to Jan before I got on the phone with you.
Oh.
And he seems a bit more animated. I think Luke's talk of just Jones all the time, basically talking as if he's going to go right through him, has kind of got under Jan's skin a bit. And we were kind of talking about whether it has a contrast to the old Michael Bisping loss Luke suffered in their rematch for that title belt. You know, he feels as though that left hand could come into play for him in this fight. So that's an interesting little thing to watch out for, maybe.
Oh, I think one of the biggest question marks heading into Saturday is Luke Rockhold. What does he look like? How does he fight at 205? Yeah. Again, like, I have a lot of questions, so I would not be shocked if Jan pulls off the quote-unquote upset. I'm not overlooking him. Obviously, Rockhold versus Jones, there's a lot more of a storyline there, and Rockhold's a lot more popular here in the United States. But yeah, don't take that like I was looking past Jan at all. I have a lot of respect for him. I just don't know how much, you know, how much interest there is in a John Jones versus Jan Błachowicz title fight at this juncture. Maybe I'm wrong.
It'd be massive.
All right.
Absolutely
fair enough.
Huge.
PT, appreciate your time as always, my man. Thank you very much. And again, great stuff with that article. Welcome to the squad. I'm looking forward to more, and keep up the great work over at MMAfighting.com and with the Eurobash podcast, which, other than my own podcast, my favorite MMA podcast out there.
Some would argue it's even better. I'm just saying, Ariel.
Yeah.
Some would argue that.
No.
Not me. Some people. That's
they would be crazy, but, you know, there's no accounting for taste, right?
Come here. Next time Mark's on before me, will you just get rid of him like 5 minutes early? I think he's just trying to wreck me buzz at this point. You know what I mean?
Wreck me buzz. I love it. Thank you, PT. I will take note of that, and I will pass the message on to Mark. Thank you very much to PT Carroll, the great PT Carroll, for stopping by. Speaking of great podcasts, just wanted to take a quick moment here in between our guests and tell all of you who I know are also big pro wrestling fans that my good pal Peter Rosenberg has his podcast Cheap Heat, which you can get over on all the podcast app out there. In the very near future, he's going to be breaking down the AEW Fighter Fest, and he will also discuss Paul Heyman's immediate impact on Raw. Yes, that's what they tell me. Peter does it better than anyone else out there. He'll be doing that over on the Cheap Heat podcast, which you can find right now on your favorite podcast app. I should have said that little promo while Mark was on the show, but it's actually apropos because we're talking about podcasts here, and I do believe our next guest is about to launch his own podcast. Very excited to say hello once again to my old friend Sean Alshadi. I haven't talked to him, at least on the air, in quite some time. He's one of the newest members over at The Athletic. He's doing great things there. He just published an amazing article, which we will talk about in a second. But first, let us go back to Las Vegas and say hello to Sean. Sean, are you there?
Ariel, my man. I've missed you so very much.
It's been a while. You're still there. It's amazing. You're still kicking it.
I'm still there, and it's funny you mentioned podcasts. We just finished recording our very first episode of the Man and the Myth podcast with someone you might know, Chuck Mendenhall. So you're going to have a new podcast in that rotation.
Wow. Look at that. Cheap plug. I love it. How did it go?
It went well. It went well. I appreciate you.
All right. So we will look out for that, and we could get that over at The Athletic, correct?
Yes, sir. And it will be free for the entire first month for non-subscribers as well.
All right. That is great news. So I'm looking forward to that. Chuck, Sean, two of the best in the business. You guys know Chuck, friend of the program, has been on in the past. And, of course, everyone knows the man in the hat. So I'm very much looking forward to that. I loved your feature on Michael Bisping that came out yesterday. You've been working on that for what seems like forever. I think 2 years to be exact. In the end, what was it, like 20,000 words? Is that accurate?
Oh, man. So my poor editor, Dan Stubbs, my first draft I turned into him was probably 24,000, I think.
Wow.
Then over the course of a few days, I was able to pare it down to about 17,000. But yeah, and apparently I have to write a 17,000-word feature to get on your show, but I appreciate it.
Well, that's always what I said. I told Troy before the show that we don't entertain 16,000-word pieces, only 17 and up here on the program. So you finally made it. Welcome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It was great. I mean, if people haven't read it, and I urge you to read it, it's somewhat of an oral history, if you will, on what it's like to fight Michael Bisping, the enigma that is Michael Bisping, the legend that is Michael Bisping, the former champion that is Michael Bisping, the now future Hall of Famer. He's about to become a Hall of Famer on Friday, officially, Michael Bisping. And I'm wondering, you spoke to all these guys, and it's just riveting to read all their different takes and the anecdotes and the stories and the experiences. What, if anything, did you learn that was new about Michael Bisping? Because we have covered him for so long. He's been in the limelight for so long. At this point, I feel like we know so much about him. But for you, talking to these people and getting their perspectives, what, if anything, did you learn that you didn't know about him?
Yeah, you know, it was a really interesting process of doing this one, because this is the fourth one of these, this sort of series that we've done, right? Like we've done Anderson Silva, Jose Aldo, and Nate Diaz. But something kind of struck me throughout doing this one. One, that of those four, this was easily the hardest to get people to agree to talk about this guy. Guys who have fought Mike, this was by far the hardest to get former opponents to agree to talk about their experiences with this man. And I think that says something just to the way he maybe approached this game in a way that was very dissimilar to a lot of fighters of his era, especially back then. But two, the thing, and this was the one that surprised me, is the people that did want to talk about Mike, the people that agreed to talk about Mike, were very anxious to do so. They really wanted to, and they were effusive with their praise of sort of what this man did and what he accomplished to a degree that was quite stunning to me, because he, you know, he is Michael Bisping. He did ruffle some feathers along the way. But even the guys who he sort of went back and forth with, the guys like a Jorge Rivera or an Alan Belcher or whoever, who had like actual rivalries with him, they really respect what he accomplished in a way that I think surprised me. And I think it speaks to sort of what Michael Bisping embodied throughout his career, because he was never one of those guys who looked great getting off the bus. He was never one of those guys with an insane physique or all these traits, these attributes, speed, power, et cetera. He kind of just got by on technique, heart, determination, and it was in a way that I think maybe was hard for fans and media to really understand what we were watching at the time. And I think probably a lot of opponents and fighters, too, were looking at this guy and saying, you know, he doesn't deserve the spot that he's in. He doesn't deserve all these main event spots. He doesn't deserve all the popularity that he's getting. But then, I mean, Chael Sonnen, your good friend Chael, says throughout the piece a couple different times in very poignant ways, you don't understand with Mike until you got in there. Once you got in there with him, then you understood what it was like to fight a man who was just never, ever going to stop. He was going to keep going no matter what until you killed him. And that alone is something that, you know, I think 5% of fighters embody. But that really seemed to be sort of the overriding thing with Mike, is that all of these guys in various ways basically said, he is the epitome of a fighter. He is the embodiment of a fighter. Of just whatever that mentality is, he has it through and through, and he always has. That never changed.
Do you think that his legacy would have been viewed differently had he never won the belt, had he never shocked the world against Luke Rockhold? And if so, do you feel like that is fair? Because let's not forget, up until that point, he had 28 wins. He only won one more time after that. Would that be fair?
I think that's fair. I think that's absolutely fair, and I think we all kind of know what his legacy was going to be, because we all kind of relegated him to that place already, right? Like before he had this sort of this magical last chapter, he was that guy. He was the the bridesmaid, who was never the bride. He was probably going to go down as maybe the best fighter to never even challenge for a title, nonetheless win for a title or win the title. And it was also this situation where he kept getting to these spots because he was a very popular fighter. He kept getting these opportunities, and he would fall short in very, very unique ways, right? Because you have the Dan Henderson knockout at UFC 100, probably one of the most outrageous, devastating knockouts in history, on the biggest card that anybody had ever seen at that point in time. You have the Chael Sonnen fight where he fights Chael Sonnen on short notice and basically beats him. Even Chael kind of thinks that might beat him for that fight, but yet doesn't get the win. And then you had the Vitor Belfort fight where he's fighting this guy who's effectively on PEDs, and he gets blinded in one eye because of it, and yet he just continually keeps getting back up and coming forward and trying again and trying to climb that mountaintop again, even into his late 30s. If that sort of 2016 never happened, I think we look at Mike as maybe a tragic figure to some degree, depending on, I mean, a lot of people probably wouldn't because they didn't like him, but I think the overall narrative of him is so, so drastically different just because of the value that we put on these belts and all of this gold. But it really does show, it is the perfect epitomization of just how important one night can be in this sport, right? Because you can change your legacy to such an outrageous degree in one night, and no one showed that more than Mike.
Yeah, and we were just talking about that earlier with your good friend Mark, regarding Holly Holm and Thiago Santos. And as I mentioned, Mike is being inducted into the Hall of Fame on Friday. His last fight was November of 2017. Rashad Evans is also being inducted into the Hall of Fame on Friday. His last fight was in June of 2018. How do you feel about them, you know, putting in these guys who we just saw not that long ago, who are very much in the public eye, as opposed to other sports where, you know, there's a 4 or 5 year grace period where you kind of miss, like, to me, Rich Franklin feels a little different than Bisping and Evans because we don't see him as much. We don't hear from him as much. Do you mind that they just put these guys right after they retire, or would you prefer a bit of a grace period there?
I think with guys like Mike and Rashad, I don't mind it as much, just because it was pretty apparent that, you know, I'd say both of them were pretty clearly done. Mike made it very, very straightforward when he retired that, you know, I already did what I needed to do. I accomplished what I was trying to do. There isn't really anything left for me. And Rashad, I think we sort of saw that coming for a long time with him. The way it gets weird is if you do guys like Faber, right? Because they did Faber right after he retired, and now we're about to see Uriah Faber fight again. And BJ Penn, same type of thing. How many times has he fought since he was a Hall of Famer? When they rush it in a way that maybe this guy doesn't feel like he's quite finished, that's when it sort of bothers me to some degree. But it is also very arbitrary because this is just the UFC Hall of Fame and not really an MMA Hall of Fame. There are Jens Pulver, Frank Shamrock. There are a lot of guys that should be in there that aren't. But I will say, I mean, and I was just talking about this with my good friend Chuck on our show. I kind of like what they've done with this year's Hall of Fame class, because you look at the years past, there's a lot of legends, et cetera, like that. Mike, Rashad, Rich, all of those guys were sort of this same era. They were basically all fighting at the exact same time, and they all sort of represent maybe the same period in time in the sport. And I kind of like just doing that all as a group of, look at what these guys did throughout, you know, this length of time, and let's celebrate that. It kind of is a theme almost, and I don't know, I'm a mark for themed things like that. So I like it sometimes, and I don't like it sometimes, but I like this year's class. It makes sense to me.
So I'm often critical of the Hall of Fame, and I try to catch myself because, as you just mentioned, it's more like when a team retires a number, right? It's their discretion. They could do whatever they want. There's no real rhyme or reason to it. I mean, the Golden State Warriors just announced that, you know, they're essentially going to retire Kevin Durant's number, and he only played 3 years there. So, like, those are the kind of things that aren't really that important. I mean, they could pretty much write their own rules. But because it's called the Hall of Fame, I think subconsciously instill these rules and say that I want it like the other sports do it. And I want, you know, a 4-year grace period and things like that. In this particular case, I wish there was an old school guy. That's my only gripe. I wish there was a pioneer, if you will. I wish there was a Jens Pulver, a Frank Shamrock, one of those guys, just to sort of legitimize it a little bit and not make it feel as current. Do you have an issue with the fight? Like, sometimes I feel like the fights, like, is that pushing it? Or it's kind of a cool thing. I don't know. So I go back and forth on the fight entry, if you will. Do you like it, or do you have issues with it like I do sometimes? I'm not trying to hate on it. I'm not trying to be a negative Nazi. But sometimes I feel like when you give someone a Hall of Fame type of status, and then you're putting in a fight is Diego Sanchez now a Hall of Famer, or is he part of a Hall of Fame fight? It just gets a little murky.
Yeah, I think murky is the right word. That was probably what I was going to say. Is the fights are the only aspect of this that feels murky to me. Because, I mean, Diego Sanchez probably will be a Hall of Famer when he retires. But, like, is Clay Guida a Hall of Famer now? Do we consider him one? Or is he just, like, maybe half of one? That's sort of maybe the weirdest nuance to this to me. But I don't take it too seriously, if I'm being quite honest. I mean, this is something these guys feel good about. It means something to them. And I think that at least is something. I mean, you've got a guy like a Clay Guida, Diego Sanchez, who have been doing this forever. I can appreciate some level of them getting some level of recognition, maybe for something that they did a long time ago that they probably won't, whenever they do decide to hang it up.
Yeah, I'm curious if Diego Sanchez is going to show up to the Hall of Fame on Friday, because of course he's fighting Michael Chiesa the next day. I feel like the smart money says he does show up. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. I bet he shows up and he gives a speech that ends up going 20 minutes overtime.
Yes. And shows up. Like, doesn't mail it in with an acceptance speech. Like, actually shows up in person.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you.
Yeah. What a legend that Diego Sanchez. Gotta love him. You're in Las Vegas right now. Is it too early to ask about the buzz, about the scene, about the vibe in the air? Have you not gotten a sense for it? Or do you feel like this is, you know, because International Fight Week, let's be honest, has been somewhat cursed over the years. Like, it always seems like at the last minute, you know, UFC 200 and 213, like, there's been a stretch of some bad luck. 189 had the Aldo thing. Do you feel a good buzz in the air?
I think it's too early to say because we haven't really even gotten started yet. The open workouts are in a couple hours. But it is, I mean, the curse of International Fight Week at this point feels long established. Like, I remember one of the moments that stands out to me the most just throughout my career is UFC 200 when me, you, and Mark, we're all in Las Vegas, and just that entire week was insanity. It felt like each day lasted 72 hours and had 40 different twists and turns.
Yes.
Hopefully this week is not like that. They have a really nice slate set up with these two title fights, and then, to use your phrase, the people's main event between Ben Askren and Jorge Masvidal. There's a lot of intrigue up and down the card. I hope it doesn't get to that point. It feels like, and almost this is weird to say because, you know, John's been back in our life. John Jones has been back in our life now for about 7 months. Each of his first two fights when he was back, there was a lot of noise. There's a lot of drama surrounding it, whether it was moving the Gustafson fight short notice or whether it was the Anthony Smith fight, like right before the week started, all the picograms thing came back to light. We haven't heard anything like that at all with John this week. And it's almost jarring in a way. You expect the John Jones fight, you expect some level of outside drama like that. Been unusually quiet. Yes. I don't know if that means something is coming, but it's low key in regards to the curse so far. Let's hope it stays that way.
Yeah, I'll never forget, like, it was my second week at ESPN last year, this time, the Wednesday, and we were about to tape Ariel and the Bad Guy, like our second episode, and I walked into my boss's office, and he was like, oh, this is pretty good, you know, no real drama, let's hope for nothing. And then literally 6 hours later, we find out that Max Holloway is out. Remember that? Against Brian Ortega. So far, as I said earlier, we've only lost Sean O'Malley. That was a couple of weeks ago. And we also lost JDS and Ganu, but that was just moved to make up for the lack of main event in Minnesota. But so far, the full slate is intact, and we hope that remains to be true come Saturday. Sean, it was great to catch up with you, my man. Keep up the great work over at The Athletic. I'm looking forward to the debut podcast. When does it come out? Does it come out Wednesday, Thursday?
Yeah, it's going to come out later today, Wednesday.
All right. I'm looking forward to that, and I look forward to seeing you out there in Las Vegas. Thanks for doing this.
Absolutely, man. Thank you.
There he is, Sean Alshadi of The Athletic, my longtime friend and colleague. from my MMAfighting.com days. Yes, the slate is an interesting one. UFC 239 this Saturday. Of note, Jack Marshman versus Edmund Shabazian on the prelims. That's 6:15 as far as the start time on ESPN+. Also of note, Claudia Gadelha versus Ronda Marcos on the ESPN prelims beginning at 8. And as I mentioned, beginning at 8:30, I will have my ESPN radio show. So we could watch the fights together, essentially. We could talk about them. Arnold Allen versus Gilbert Melendez. That's a fascinating fight on the prelims as well. And then the main card, Michael Chiesa versus Diego Sanchez. Jan Błachowicz against Luke Rockhold. Ben Askren against Jorge Masvidal. Amanda Nunes versus Holly Holm for the women's bantamweight title. And, of course, John Jones against Thiago Santos for the UFC light heavyweight title. I'm looking forward to it again. Going to Las Vegas on Thursday. MMA Awards tonight. Thanks to all who voted for me. I appreciate it very much. We'll find out if we can make it 9 in a row. I'm very thankful to be nominated once again and to be recognized. And I congratulate all the other nominees. I always feel, as I said before, as I said with Gareth, I feel like it's about the fighters. It's fighters only. But I appreciate the nod nonetheless. Thanks to all who stopped by today. Thank you very much to Sean Alshadi. Thank you very much to Pete C. Carroll and, of course, Mark Ramundi. I appreciate all of you who continue to support the podcast over on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, all the places where you get your podcasts. Thank you for continuing to download, rating, subscribing, all those things that you do in order to have your podcast be popular and well liked. All right, we are out of time. I'm off to Las Vegas again. Thank you very much for listening. I'll talk to you out there. We've got a lot more UFC 239 coverage to come. Can't wait for it. Keep it locked. I'll speak to you later in the week.